kids. Matt Segundo here. Some cultural commentators have described my sad, dreary life as nothing less than a 50-year cartoon to be ridiculed by dutiful academics. What purpose, then, is there in holing up in a Motel 6 room and meeting out colorful introductions for a cultural podcast? To what end am I drinking my bleary days away? Therefore, what purpose do cartoons ultimately have? The independent animator Bill Plimpton did not have answers to these questions, but I should point out that he's doing much better than I am.
Okay, so I am here with independent animator Bill Plimpton. Bill, how are you doing today?
Very good.
First of all, I wanted to touch upon aspects of your work and then kind of lead into this latest project that you have going. I wanted to first of all ask you about something that's long been curious to me. The suit guys who have these sort of square shoulders and who likewise seem to have these very large frames and these very big asses and these very short legs. I'm wondering how this particular look came about.
Well, that's a very good question because I see a lot of young animators doing cartoons. A lot of the cartoons on Cartoon Network that use the format that zany-looking people are funny, like clowns or animals with big bulbous eyes and huge noses and tongues that stick out and big ears and crazy hair. And it's my feeling that that's really not funny. For me, humor comes across when you take something that's normal, that's placid, that's bland, that's a cliche, and do something weird to it. If your main character is weird already, when something weird happens, it's not a surprise. It's not a shock, therefore it's not funny. So I like to choose characters that are fairly bland, like vacuum cleaner salesmen, very normal, and someone you can identify with. I guess that character who's originated in your face was inspired a little bit by Bud Abbott on Abbott and Costello, the pencil-thin mustache guy with a suit and slick back hair and kind of a sleazy salesman type guy. And that was such a big success. That film was such a huge hit that I continued that character on through The Wise Man and through Push Comes to Shove and a bunch of my feature films, The Toon and Mutant Aliens and I Married a Strange Person. So those films use that character a lot, and I found that he's a very good character for laughs.
In Push Comes to Shove, that character resembles Alfred Hitchcock to some degree.
Well, no, not at all, I don't think. Because Alfred Hitchcock is really a caricature. And this guy, even though he is a little stockier, there were two guys in Push Comes to Shove, a thin guy and a stockier guy. And actually, I guess that was inspired by the old Laurel and Hardy gag where they would take a egg and squash it on his head and put the hat back on. It was very dry humor, very deadpan humor. Yeah. And then that would escalate. And it escalated into, I don't know, getting hit by a board or, you know, something like that. Well, I wanted to take that escalation and exaggerate it even more so it becomes so violent and so surreally violent that it's just preposterous.
Yeah.
And that was my initial inspiration for that film. So Alfred Hitchcock wouldn't be someone I would say. It's more like Laurel and Hardy, although even then, Oliver Hardy is more of a caricature that I would want to use. I brought him down as to more of a normal person than Oliver Hardy.
It also reminds me very much of the fish slapping dance, that kind of one-upmanship between the two characters.
That's exactly was the inspiration, yeah.
Huh, interesting. I wanted to also ask you about some of the perspectives that you have in this. You've had a few shorts and also in your features, this kind of first-person perspective. Mm-hmm. I think of the tree, for example.
Exciting Life of a Tree. One of those days.
Yes, exactly. And I'm wondering, in terms of how this first-person perspective came about, is this something that you just needed to kind of get away from the typical kind of third-person look of these particular shorts that were...
Well, the magic of animation is that the camera can go anywhere you want. And it's harder to do that in live action, although it's easier now with digital technology, digital effects. But with animation, you can put the camera anywhere, and that's part of the fun of it, is just seeing something that is maybe cliched or boring from a different angle, and it makes it exciting, it makes it interesting. And so I wanted to see an event from one person's POV and just see the worst day ever, what it would be if you live that life, if you were actually put in that person's place. So it's very autobiographical in that sense. But I like to do that a lot. I did another film called Draw.
Yeah.
Where it's a cliche of two cowboys in Main Street, Texas town, and they draw their guns. Only this is a POV of a bullet.
Yeah.
And so it's a cliched, boring kind of situation. But when you see it from the eye of a bullet that is traveling through space, going towards someone's heart, it is gives it a whole new perspective.
Yeah.
And I love that kind of thing that you can do with animation is change perspective, change the viewpoint in each shot. And that's one reason I love animation.
Is this why you often are drawn to weapons? Because not just bullets and cannons and the like, but also chainsaws, I have to ask you about, and cutting people in half. This seems to be a common theme throughout the work.
Movies have always been violent, whether it's Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton or Abbott and Costello or the Marx Brothers. Violence has always been, or Roadrunner is a perfect example. Violence has always been part of humor, and so has sex. I don't know why a lot of Americans are offended by sex in cartoons. It never made sense to me when they grew up with Mae West and all these Gene Harlow and Marilyn Monroe, and there was always sex in adult films, and I just thought cartoons should also have sex. And so the violence is American as apple pie, and so I like to take the violence though and exaggerate it to such an absurd degree that it's not really scary anymore, it's funny. I saw those Saw films, and I was actually very squeamish about it, and it really wasn't my cup of tea. But I think if they had taken that humor or the violence and exaggerated it to an absurd level, I think it would have been much more interesting and a lot more entertaining.
Violence is somehow more comforting if it's framed within a comic context, then.
Yeah, but it's that whole exaggeration that makes it work. The Roadrunner stuff, of course, is totally implausible, and that's what makes it funny. And Saw is actually plausible. You know, there's probably people that do, you know, manacle victims in their basements and do these evil things on them. But the Roadrunner cartoons, it takes it to another whole nother level, and that's where I find the humor.
It's funny you mentioned the Roadrunner, because there are many instances in your films where characters fall from a large height onto the ground, and I'm wondering if that was very much inspired by the Roadrunner.
Well, I can only say that I loved Roadrunner as a kid. I thought they were really great cartoons and the funniest thing around. Having said that, though, I must admit that I'm not a big Chuck Jones fan. I think he's done a bunch of good films, but I know a lot of people think Chuck Jones is God. I have problems with some of his films are just too cute for me, just too sweet, too warm, too cuddly.
Huh.
My heroes are Bob Clampett and Tex Avery, who really push the limits of visual storytelling, and so those are my two heroes.
But on a certain level, you do have to appeal to an audience. I mean, even though you have a dark streak throughout your work, you also have very endearing characters.
No, I don't. I wish I could say that. I guess Guard Dog is starting to get that way. He's become a little more lovable, but I try not to use that too much. I really don't want to do films for kids. Yeah. That's not my. It's not what I think. I mean, that's another thing that bugs me is everybody thinks that cartoons should be for children, but you know, I don't think about playing with a ball all day, or I don't think about playing on the swings, or you know, riding a tricycle. And that's not what my everyday experience is. My everyday experience is about death and loss and violence and sex and mature things. So why should I make films about playing with a ball all day when I want to make films about death and love and passion and sex? And it just doesn't make sense why I am limited to what I can make films about.
But there's also a very sweet quality to the tune, and also The Fan and the Flower, which of course didn't come from your hands.
Didn't come from my head, and the tune was pretty much innocent because Maureen McKellen was involved in it, and that's the way she is. And actually, that was, you know, I was okay with it. But I think I was influenced a lot by the Japanese animation started coming in about that time. And a lot of more adult fare was coming in, you know, Ralph Bakshi and people like that. And so I really felt that that was where the future of animation was going. I think Disney had shown that you can make great films for kids in animation. I didn't want to do what Disney was doing. I wanted to do my own thing. I wanted to do adult films from a perspective of an American, not, you know, a Japanese. So that I felt that I was pretty much in virgin territory there. Although Ralph Bakshi did it earlier, I felt that nobody else was taking up that challenge or that genre. Yeah. And I just thought there was a huge market there for that kind of humor.
But I'm wondering if a adult film can't be endearing in some sense. I was sort of suggesting that with the previous observation of mine, and you insisted that they aren't. But
Pixar certainly does do films that are wonderful for adults, and they are certainly endearing. And I always have a happy ending. My films never have a sad ending. But I feel that to make my kind of humor, it has to be real dark. I love dark humor. I love, you know, Charles Adams, people like that. I think sick humor, Michael O'Donohue. That's the kind of stuff that I really enjoy doing, just making people, you know, freak out. And it's interesting because there's been a lot of live action films that have done very well using that humor. The Farley Brothers done very well. They're, you know, Something About Mary is a classic. And Airplane, you know, has a lot of sick humor in it. So that's the kind of stuff I want to do in animation, and no one's doing it.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a perfect venue.
Going back to this involvement with Maureen, I also wanted to ask you about the role of music in your films. Obviously, your face was very much based off of the song, and it sort of triggered these moments. But there's also the Jesus film as well,
right,
which also is rooted in a song. Does a song kind of help you to find your bearings or kickstart the free association?
Not so much that. I just like the feeling of music with animation. There's something pure about that. I mean, going all the way back to Betty Boop and Fantasia and the Merry Melodies. There's something really natural about animation and music. And again, I like music that is a more populist music. You know, country western and kind of real. Kind of down-home music. I'm not big on orchestral John Williams kind of stuff or jazz. I just like real kind of populist music. So I felt that there's a purity there that is really, really wonderful. In fact, in the new film I'm doing, Idiots and Angels, has no dialogue at all. It's pure sound effects and music. And I showed it to my French distributors, and they were a little perturbed that there's so much music in it. And I tried cutting some of the songs out, and I just felt there was a big hole there without the music. And so even though it's not like one big music video, there is a lot of music. In fact, we used, Moby did a song, and Tom Waits did a couple songs, and Pink Martini did some music. So I think we got some really wonderful, wonderful music in there, and we're very excited about it.
I'm curious about resorting to music or basically international sounds. I mean, Eat is very much like this as well. It could be seen in almost any particular country. Mm-hmm. Is this now kind of a concern because you're distributing these films yourself, you're playing the festival circuits and the like, and even if we're talking about DVDs, you're almost having to resort to the web to get your work out there. So I'm wondering if it's really become a sort of situation in which you can't quite access these American distribution conduits, and you have to sort of create something that is more international in scope that can sort of play everywhere in these days.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if you're right or not. You could be right. I've had a spotty record in terms of the features. The shorts always do very well. I have no problem with shorts, both domestically and foreign. The features are not so successful. I wish they were more successful. I think I Married a Strange Person was probably my biggest success. Mutant Aliens, the space one, did fairly well overseas, but I distributed it myself in the U.S. Hair High, which I thought would be a big hit because it had so many stars in it. You know, David Carradine and Sarah Silverman and Martha Plimpton and Dermot Mulroney, and really a great cast. And that didn't excite any interest from the distributors. So, and I spent a lot of money on Hair High, quite frankly. It was a big chunk of money. So this new film, Idiots and Angels, is low budget, like $100,000 or maybe more. No voices. I did all the artwork myself, all the backgrounds, all the drawings. The only real expenses were the coloring and shading and the music and the sound effects.
So really, it was a cost-cutting measure, or was it a matter of also, well, you put all these voices in Hair High, and so therefore, well, maybe we should kind of go back to what sells. Is that really what the indicator is?
It's not what sells, it's just what I can afford.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so if Idiots and Angels is not a big success, at least I didn't lose a lot of money on it, and I know I can make that money back just in Europe alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it doesn't sell big in the U.S. or Asia or South America. At least I can make my investment back in Europe. But I do have high hopes for it. People who've seen it are really knocked out by the visuals. It's more like a Triplets of Belleville, where there is no dialogue, and it's a much darker film. It's a more mysterious film. It's kind of like David Lynch, if David Lynch did an animated feature. So it's a little more adult than my usual stuff. It's not like a gag every 20 seconds. It's a little has more depth to it. It's a little more symbolic and has a deeper meaning than my usual stuff. And I usually don't like making that kind of film, but this idea just came to me, and I thought it was a wonderful idea, so I did it.
I wanted to also ask, and maybe you can touch upon how this issue relates to this film, your sort of use of backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Your early stuff has a lot of white space in it, has a lot of, and this kind of allows your characters to kind of free float within this kind of white expanse. Mm-hmm. And yet we see, largely with like films like Eat and Mutant Aliens, mm-hmm. this greater attention to background. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if this came about from a need to sort of, I guess, keep the ambitions going, from a need to continue to evolve as a filmmaker on this, mm-hmm. or whether it just was one of those, I guess, natural progressions. And does background, having details like that, does it kind of limit the ability for, like, say, a character to, like in Nose Hair, to walk along a plane and to sort of encounter various elements?
No, there's a number of reasons why the background's a lot more detailed now. One is I have the money and the time to put in some good backgrounds. I think with these large screen televisions and on the movie screens, it's better to have a little more going on than just a white background. Also, I just think it's more sophisticated. You can tell more of your story if there's information in the background that helps define the character, define the situation, give the mood. And white backgrounds are good for shorts and simple things like that, but for the feature, you just can't get by with white backgrounds. Although I do have a number of scenes in Idiots and Angels where the backgrounds are texture, just a flat texture. So they're not white, but they have a texture, and that gives a nice grittiness to it that it feels a little more intense than just a white background.
I was also curious about shadows and silhouettes, which enter in from roughly around Mutant Aliens onwards, as well as a greater attention to cinematic angles in the sense of having pans and zooms and things along those lines. Did this arise from making feature films and thinking more in terms of cinematic conventions, or was this having the time to do this?
No, I've been doing shadows for a long time, and for me, shadows and shading.
Yeah.
Shading is really important part of the art of storytelling because it gives the characters more volume. You feel like they're real people, they're shadows in their clothing, and it gives them volume and they're just more substantial. And it's an interesting question because I see a lot of these not early Disney films, but from the 80s and 90s, what's that one, Treasure Planet, you know, things like that, where they didn't use shading. They just used flat colors, flat images. And you'd think that with Disney, with, you know, 100 $100 million, $200 million to put in a film, they could at least put some shadows in there. And then you compare it to a film like a Miyazaki film, Princess Mononoke or Poco Rosso or something like that, and you see the shading in there and you feel, oh my God, that those characters look so real, they look so alive, they look so rich, they're just, you can, they're like dessert, you can eat them, they're so beautiful to look at. And so I always felt that shading and shadows were a really important part of the storytelling, and why a studio like Disney or some of the Warner Brothers films did not use shading, I don't know. So I've been doing it ever since I was an illustrator. You can go back and see some of my illustrations when I was doing stuff for New York Times or, you know, Rolling Stone, and I always had shading in there because I just felt that that was really the best way to define a character, is just with the shading.
You've alluded a couple of times to both anime and also Miyazaki, and I'm wondering if this might be a key influence to your narratives, because I look at a short like Parking, and there are a number of things in there that I immediately sort of see this definite anime influence. You have him going, huh? Like in those animes, and also there's this practice you have of issuing a graphic novel before you actually make the film as a sort of blueprint, which is very similar to what anime does. Yeah. And there's also a point in Parking where the cannonball is going and you see these sort of line streaks that you only see in anime. So I wanted to kind of ask you about, was Parking kind of where everything kind of came together for that?
No, I was influenced by anime earlier than that. I think Akira was the first film that I saw that really blew me away. And certainly anime has a big influence on me. The openness of the sexual content was very liberating to me. That actually inspired I Married a Strange Person. And a lot of the techniques, like you say, the shadows and the silhouettes, the flashing backgrounds, were very subtly stolen from Japanese animation.
There's even a nuclear motif in that, too.
You're right. But the storytelling is me, really. I'm not big on Japanese storytelling. I never really understood a lot of their plots and their characters. I mean, something like Paprika, I still don't know. I've seen it two and a half times. I still don't know what it's about. And Akira, I'm not quite sure what happened there. And all the Miyazaki films are, except for Poco Rosso, I never really understood much of what was going on. I thought the Howl's Moving Castle was completely confusing. But I'd like to bring up one film that I'm championing, and this film never got released in the U.S. You probably saw it. It's called Mind Games. And I forget the name of the director. It just came out in Japan about 2 or 3 years ago, and it apparently bombed. It did not do very well. And I saw it at a screening of Asian films here in New York. And
have not seen it, but I'm going to put it on my list.
It blew me away. And I thought, this is the greatest film. And so I talked to the producer, was actually there. I said, is it coming to the U.S.? He said, no, it bombed in Japan. They'll never release it here. And so I got a disc. I forget how I got a DVD of it. And I looked at it again. It was even better. I think it's the Citizen Kane of animation. It's such a brilliant film. And I wish that somebody would champion it here in the States and get a release, because it's like the name. It's a mind-blowing film. It's just so well made and so amazing and so funny and so clever and so inventive and beautifully drawn.
And this is a problem also for you in terms of getting relying on more on word of mouth than a sort of distribution outlet.
Yeah, I never understood why my films, we have a lot of fans. I have fans love my film. I know I have an audience out there, but the distributors are afraid of me. I don't know if it's because my stuff is adult, or it's because I'm a maverick, or I make the films myself. I don't have a big studio behind me. I don't know why I have such a hard time getting distribution in the States. Outside of the States, they do fairly well. But I'm hoping that Idiots and Angels changes that and gets a good buzz and gets some fair distribution.
But if you are accepted in Europe and other countries, or rather other continents, I'm wondering if it really sort of doesn't matter whether maybe the United States is just one of those places where things do live by on word of mouth, or the internet perhaps is a kind of global distribution outlet that subverts this kind of...
That's what's going to happen eventually. I just have to sidestep a major theatrical distributor and go straight to the video on demand or iPods or whatever venue is happening in the next few years. and just make my money that way.
I know that you released the tune on Amazon Unbox, but none of your other films, and I'm curious, was this more of an experiment on your part to sort of see?
No, is that true? I didn't know this.
Yeah, I did some research on
what's
this.
What's Unbox?
Unbox, which is kind of like
what's
a...
What's Unbox?
It's, you can download the film, and then for 7 days you can view it for like $3 or something like this. And I also was curious why your stuff wasn't available on like iTunes.
This is the tune?
The tune, yes.
I own the rights to it. I wonder who's making that money, because I'm not making that money.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well,
have you heard about this? iVox?
Unbox.
Unbox.
I think it's Unbox, yeah.
Yeah, let's check out.
See, I'm glad I could inform you of this.
See who's making that money.
Yeah, it's like $3 for 7 days and $10 bucks for 30 days.
It's not coming to me. Huh. And I got the rights back because the original rights owner was only a 12-year deal. And that was 3 years ago that ended. So I do have all total ownership of that film. So that's very interesting. Thank you for bringing that up.
Well, I'll email you the link.
But we would definitely, that's the way to go, I think, you know, is because I do have a fan base, a large fan base, and I want to, I mean, they're always emailing me all the time, when's Hair High coming out? When's it going to come out? And I say, I don't know, I just, you know, we just haven't found a right deal for the DVD release yet.
But this is also problematic because Virgin, for example, is closing its stores, and there are fewer places to actually go into a store and buy a DVD.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if this is, you know, the kind of independent record store or DVD store culture might be problematic for getting something like
Yeah, I never made a lot of money on you know, Blockbuster or Virgin or places like that. Most of the money is sales through my internet site. We do really good business directly through the customers, and I obviously make more of a profit that way too. So that's sort of the way we're leaning in terms of money making scheme.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you finance all of your films, and you do for the most part. Where does commercial work fit in, or work like the Kanye West video and the like? I mean, I'm wondering if there are specific circumstances where you will be an animator for hire as opposed to doing it yourself, or if someone were to give you money. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's of course the famous incident in which you turned down Disney, and I'm curious as to, you know, are there varying levels of autonomy that you're willing to work with? Is a commercial something that you can kind of do as sort of as a hired work, or as a way to kind of test out a particular animation technique?
Well, I'm a total whore when it comes to commissioned work. The money is always good, especially with commercials. The money is very good. It's a quick job. It's, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of animation and I'm done. I don't get as much commercial work as I used to. Back in the 90s, I was very busy with commercials. Now it's mostly, like you say, music videos, which I love doing. The Kanye West piece was a real thrill, and the Weird Al Yankovic was a lot of fun to do. I'm working on another one for a European band right now. And then I do some work for film festival trailers or documentaries. I do some stuff for them. And so I like doing it. And if John Lasseter called me and said, you want to come in, you know, in Pixar and direct a feature film, I would be thrilled to death. The Disney thing just didn't work out for a number of reasons. One, that I was in the middle of the tune, so I didn't want to leave that production in midair like that. But also I would have had to move out to L.A., and they didn't tell me what they wanted me to work on. It could have been DuckTales or something really stupid. So I had to say no to that. But it was a lifelong ambition of mine to work for Disney, as most animators when they're growing up wanted to work for Disney. So I was reluctant to say no to them, but I had to.
But it's also kind of a devil's contract to some degree, because they work their animators often quite to death. I mean,
yeah, I probably wouldn't have lasted more than a couple months. You're right. They probably would have said, yeah, you're too crazy for us, you know, get out, you're too independent, get out and go back to New York.
I'm wondering though, you know, you constantly draw all of these frames, and I'm wondering, you know, you've probably done millions of these things over the course of
pretty
your
much,
career,
yeah,
and
pretty
I and
much.
I'm wondering how you don't get wrist cramp or whatnot, or what you do. I mean, how many hours generally do you work a day to draw?
Well, when I'm working on a feature film like Idiots and Angels, I'll get up at 6:30 or 7 and start drawing immediately, and then I'll come in here at 10 and work all day, and then I'll go home after at five and then work another 3 or 4 more hours. So it's, sometimes it's 12, 14 hours a day. It's a lot of drawing, but it's the pleasure. It's a real delight for me to draw these characters, to make up people, to sort of play God. And it's a dream job. I mean, I couldn't be happier doing drawings all day long. It's just such a thrill.
I'm wondering if you draw quite fast, that this allows you to do this, or I mean, maybe you can talk about how you use multiple frames for one particular drawing. I mean, wonder what circumstances will you resort to, like, say, 2 frames as opposed to, say, 6 frames.
Right. Well, that's a little tech talk. I don't know if people are interested in it, but generally speaking, a Disney film, there's one drawing per frame of film, which is 24 drawings per second. And sometimes there's more than one drawing because there's different levels, different layers, different characters. I don't have the time or the money to do a drawing every frame of film. And so consequently, my drawings are 3 frames per drawing, maybe 4 frames per drawing. So that works out to about 6 drawings per second. And so it gives a little jerky feeling that people sort of identify with me. It's kind of a shimmering kind of look, which I kind of like, actually. And so that, consequently, that lets me do a lot more animation per day than, say, a Disney film. So I can do almost half a minute to a third of a minute a day, which is 20 seconds, something like that, which is about 100 drawings.
Yeah.
Whereas a Disney film or a Pixar film, they're lucky they can get a second a week for each animator. So that's another reason my films are less expensive to make, is I do all the drawing myself and I work fast. And I know what I'm doing. I don't have to consult with producer or the distributor or the marketing guy. I know exactly what I want, and no one's going to say, no, you can't do that.
But there's also kind of an aspect of clean lines to some of your work, like The Phantom of the Flower and a few, and also Mutant Aliens to some degree. And I wanted to sort of ask you, under what circumstances are you going to go for a cleaner look as opposed to the strobe effect that is very frequent?
Well, I think the clean look is gone. Wait till you see this new film, Idiots and Angels. It's very rough textured, very loose, very overworked, very dark, very... A lot of cross-hatching, a lot of erasing and redrawing and erasing and redrawing. So it's very overworked. And it gives it a very nice haunting effect that I'm very happy with. And I think I'll probably do that for my next few films. It was so quick to do, so fast to do, and it looks so nice that I'm really happy with it.
I'm wondering if there's something to this kind of more jagged look that is perhaps more threatening to some viewers than, say, the material or, say, having sex with octopuses or whatnot.
Yeah, well, this is, I wouldn't say it's jagged. I would say it's actually softer because there's so many little tiny lines that make up the outline that it feels kind of soft. And kind of chiaroscuro, can I use that word?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a lot of light and dark, playing with light and dark and highlights and stuff. And so it's sort of an antidote to Pixar and Shrek, where every edge is hard and every line is crisp and clean and perfect. And this is imperfect. There's a lot of mistakes, a lot of blurs, a lot of errors. And I'd like seeing that on the screen. I like seeing lines that go askew and are mistakes. And for me, that's a pleasure to watch. It's like looking at a drawing in an art museum, and you see the hand of the artist behind it. Whereas Shrek or DreamWorks or Pixar, it could be anybody. It's just perfect. It's just all the lines are clean and crisp. And I'm totally against that.
Yeah. It's interesting because I actually wanted to ask you about the single stroke as a kind of antagonist or a villain in some of your films. In Nose Hair, it certainly is, but also there's the Noodle Lady in Eat and the like. I mean, there are numerous examples. Parking, you have a small spoke become the villain, and I'm wondering about this. Is this kind of an antidote by that line?
No, it's because I'm lazy. It's easier to draw a single stroke as a villain. It was just a shortcut. Sorry, I can't give you a more philosophical meaning.
But there's often situations in which someone might become untangled through the line, as of course the diner in Eat does, as a matter of fact. And I'm wondering if you think in terms of lines as opposed to textures, or what circumstances would you think of lines or textures first? Mm-hmm. Is it just a matter of just constant association, whatever seems to be right?
Yeah, that pretty much. I mean, I did that again also in drawing lesson number two. There was a line, about a line that sort of created a character. It was just easy. It just seemed like a clever idea, a shortcut way to tell a story without doing a lot of drawing.
Yeah. Well, if it's easy, how do you balance this with this greater ambition of wanting to...
Well, obviously, this is a feature film, so you can't get away with a simple line being the protagonist or the antagonist. So I really want to get into the volume of the character and the richness of the depth of the art and the modeling and the texture. And when you see it, you can see it, actually see it online. It It's an Angels up online yet? Is that up?
I looked, but I couldn't.
Yeah. We're going to start putting clips up. But you can see the clip somewhere. AWN? Can't you see it, AWN?
It was on YouTube, but it was taken down.
Oh. Well, when it does go up, which maybe by the time you this comes on air, check it out, because it really is a much different style for me, and it's a style I'm really happy with.
I'm wondering if a feature film allows you, you've kind of painted yourself into this corner of having to do something for the big screen or for HGTV, as you suggested earlier, and I'm wondering if this permits you to not be so lazy. This is a kind of a corrective impulse on your part to kind of keep constant challenge.
Yeah, I suppose so, but again, I pretty much do it for my own pleasure. I just like to make up these characters and these drawings and hear people laugh. I mean, to me, that's the biggest thrill, is to hear people in the movie theater laughing and applauding, and that makes it all worthwhile.
One thing we haven't mentioned, and it's probably pertinent in relation to Idiots and Angels, is the use of digital compositing, which started with, I believe, Guard Dog.
Yes.
Onward.
You did your homework.
Yeah. I'm wondering, however, what has possibly changed in terms of drawing everything. I mean, you're feeding these drawings into digital, but I'm wondering if you feel that there's anything that's been lost in terms of a handmade quality that you've had to kind of work.
No,
in
to the contrary, it's much richer now. I tried this technique earlier, actually. I grew up drawing with pencil. I love pencil and paper. To me, it's the ultimate art form. And we tried it with, I think it was Mutant Aliens, where I did a character and I shaded it with pencil. And so the technique back then was using camera and film. So we had to Xerox it onto acetate cells and then paint it. And it just didn't look, it just vibrated like crazy. And we could never keep a consistent texture going. It was just really... The Xerox machine would lose the subtleties in the shading. So when we went to digital scanning back for the beginning of Idiots and Angels, and as you say, Guard Dog, Guide Dog, but mostly Idiots and Angels because it's black and white, that picked up all the subtleties of the cross-hatching and the pencil and the shading and the rubbing. I would do a drawing and then I would smear it with my with tissue and smudge all the lines, so it's very very mystical and kind of dark and eerie. And that just, when I saw that, the first few frames of that, I thought, wow, finally I don't have to use film anymore, which is very expensive and very slow and very tedious and very expensive. And I can go straight to the coloring on the computer. And that was just a real breakthrough for me. And like I say, when you see Idiots and Angels, you'll say, why hasn't someone done this before? You know, it just seems so natural.
So pretty much all the coloring is now done in the computer for you, and you do everything black and white with drawings.
Exactly.
Okay, okay. I mean, that was this number about, I mean, when did you kind of know this? What kind of, how much trial and error did you do before you realized the colors wouldn't translate?
I think the first one was the... Kanye West music video.
Yeah.
That's the first time I really tried that technique, and that was pretty successful. The thing with Hot Dog was that it was colored by colored pencil. So that had all the texture and smeared it already on the paper. But with Kanye West and with Weird Al Yankovic, I did black and white, and then it was colored on the computer. And then the black really came through over the color, and it just gave it a nice effect.
I'm wondering, though, if there are any analog textures that might be lost through this particular process if it's all done digitally.
I don't know if they are. I don't know. What analog textures are you talking about?
Well, like, say, a colored pencil, the look of a colored pencil on paper versus the look of adding color in a computer? Are there any trade-offs?
Well, certainly Guard Dog and Guide Dog, and I have a new one now called Hot Dog, are different looks because they are colored pencil. But no, you'll see the black and white is very very rich, very deep, very really has great texture.
So Idiots and Angels essentially rides the chiaroscuro as opposed to color? Or?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very monochromatic. I mean, there's color in there, but it's a very subtle color. Very rich browns and grays and blues and things like that.
I'm wondering if moving to digital has kind of encouraged you to move more along these kinds of, you know, gradients of gray and the like.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think so, definitely.
Is it a matter of just being drawn to it, or is it a matter of the technology encouraging it?
Well, both. Both the technology has helped, but also it's sort of the way my storytelling is going. I used to be pretty much just a comic, an animated comic. Sex and Violence 1 and 2 were pretty much just a bunch of jokes, and Mutant Aliens and I'm a Strange Person were just a series of jokes. But now I want to get more, a little more depth, a little more into the characters, a little more into the dark side of humanity, although there is humor there. It's more of a dark storytelling.
The last series of jokes that you did was, in fact, the second Sex and Violence short. And yeah. I'm wondering if you were sort of going to the shorter shorts of shorts to kind of at least figure out how you could translate many of your ideas onto narrative, into a sort of a greater sort of sense of story. And all
yeah,
that.
I like those. Those are fun. Those are very popular. And I'd like to continue doing them, actually, because I have a whole drawer of gags that have not been used that I would like to bring out, and I still write more gags every day. So at some point I would like to bring out another one, but I'm just so busy with the features and I just don't have time.
I'm wondering, in terms of, maybe you could talk about this in relation to Idiots and Angels, but how much planning goes into the outline and how much of this is kind of discovered in the process of actually drawing the art? Are there gags that find their way in a latter stage of the production? Or?
Well, Idiots and Angels was a different kind of film where it wasn't a comic-based film. It was more of a surreal storytelling film. And I spent a year on the script. I don't know where the idea came from. It's about a asshole guy who grows wings and doesn't like it because the wings are very make him do good things, and he doesn't want to do good things. He wants to be greedy and selfish. So it's a very simple idea, and it took me about a year to write the storyboard. I mean, I was doing other projects during the time, but in my spare time I was writing on the script. And certainly it was revised many times. And then when I do the storyboards, then a lot of ideas will pop up. Little humorous ideas, humorous gags will pop up. And if they're funny, I'll include them in. But it's a very organic kind of process that things are always changing. Even now we're doing the final editing and, little things pop up and I use them or I don't use them.
Yeah. Well, this emphasis on the body, again, has been throughout your book. And in fact, it's reminiscent to some degree of, although it's not nearly, it's a little bit different but in terms of conceptual, but Cronenberg and Ballard kind of come to mind in the way that you sort of show how mood is affected by a slight change in the body. And I'm wondering if you might be able to describe how you became obsessed with the body, or is this was something that just constantly preoccupied you and just naturally...
Well, no, I think everybody is obsessed with the body. I think it's probably the most important visual icon there is, the human body. I mean, we watch TV, we watch to see what humans do, how they act, how they look. As an illustrator, 95% of everything I drew was the human body. And people around the world are obsessed with the human body. So it's nothing that I have a monopoly on. It's just that for me, it's fun to draw it. And it's fun to make the human body do weird things. I think it's very fascinating to watch it.
Does it encourage you to offer this more surrealistic, canted approach to your illustration, that just really you kind can't draw something without at least maybe having some element that's out of whack?
Well, yeah, surrealism works so much better on the human body than other animals or buildings or cars or something like that. It's the surrealism is worthless without the human body.
What steps do you take to get out of the house and access the real world and bring personal experience into many of these films?
Well, I live in New York City, as you know, and just walking the streets of the city, it's a cartoon city, and a lot of people are so outrageous and so wacky and so different and such a variety that I get a lot of ideas just walking through the street, and that's where most of my ideas come from, quite frankly, is just seeing things. Well, for example, the Guard Dog film was inspired by a dog I saw in Madison Square Park, just right near where I live. And this dog was barking at a little bird, and I thought, why is this dog afraid of a tiny little bird? And so I went inside the dog's brain and realized that he was afraid that the bird would kill his master and he would lose his meal ticket. And so with that wacky kind of explanation, I built a whole film and a whole series of short films around the guard dog. So it's just inspirations like that contribute all my ideas.
Well, Bill, I know you have to go, but thanks very much for taking the time out to talk.
My pleasure.
All right, thanks.
And I heard him say, nothing's ever promised tomorrow today. From the shy like Tim, it's a harder way. So this is in the name of love, like Robert say. Before you ask me to go get a job today, can I at least get a raise on the minimum wage? And I know the government administer AIDS, so I guess we just pray like the ministers say. Alu Akbar and throwing some hot cars. The things we seen on the screen, it's not ours. But these niggas from the hood, so these dreams that far. Where I'm from, the dope boys is the rock stars, but they can't cop cars without seeing cop cars.